Accession number 27083, Reel 34.
So Henry, you've just been asked where you had come from and where you were going now.
Yes, and what are you going to do now, he said. And I said that I was going with the rest of the squadron to Naples. Ah, yes, he said, Naples, yes. Now let me think. There's something you really ought to do when you go to Naples. You go up the mountain in one of these funiculars. Yes, that's it. You go, but he doesn't take you right to the top, and you have to get out and walk the last bit. And it's well worth it, because when you do get to the top, now what is it? You look down into the crater, sir? No, but it's terribly worthwhile. It's very worthwhile. And by this time, you know, I was hard put to keep a straight face, frankly. And that was my call on the Commander-in-Chief Mediterranean. And we went to Naples, and I haven't got very much to say about that. But when we got back, I found that my Dipso chief bosun's mate had been dried out, hopefully, and had been returned to me. Now, everybody in the ship, all the sailors of whatever department, knew where he'd gone and didn't expect to see him back, and there he was back. And I made it quite clear. I made a date to see the captain of the fleet, who was a senior captain, a man called Robin Buckley. I don't know how he ever became a captain, but anyway, he did. He wasn't much cop. And I made a date to see him, because I didn't want this chap in my ship. I didn't think it was fair on him, as I said. He was an extremely nice man. If he'd been put in the right place, he might have done a useful job. But I certainly was not prepared to have him back as my chief bosun's mate. And I went and saw him and told him this, and he started to pull rank and was very unpleasant about it. And he said, well, I don't know, but I think that I think it's more than likely that the commander-in-chief will order you to take him back as your chief bosun's mate. And I said, this really rather shocked me, because it was a very silly thing for him to have said, but he'd said it. And I have to say, I didn't much care for him, nor did I hold him in great respect. And I said, well, to start with, I don't think the Commander-in-Chief is in any position to give such an order, but if by any conceivable chance he does, then I have to tell him that you'll have to find a new commanding officer. And he glared at me, and that was it. That was the end of the interview, and he did nothing to help. So I concocted a job for this unfortunate man and called him the First Lieutenant's Assistant, which meant that he had really nothing to do and certainly no responsibility, and was never in a position of taking charge of an evolution or sailors having to do things on the upper deck under dangerous conditions and so forth. And I realized that in so doing, I was, of course, giving him an open invitation to return to the bottle. But that was too bad, because he shouldn't have come back to me, and so forth. And needless to say, in due course, he returned to the bottle. So that was a sad story, because he was a very nice man. Now, around this time, I got fed up with the poor quality, poor standard of gunnery that we had with our four or five men on, but we had four twin four or five turrets. And I was determined that we would get this corrected. There was something fundamentally wrong. We had never bowled it out at Portland. We'd never looked anywhere near like hitting the target and having an anti-aircraft fire and so on and so forth. And I got on to one of the ordnance chaps in the dockyard and got him to really go to town in the director. And they discovered, I won't go into technical detail, but they discovered a half degree error in the master sight and the director. So it was hardly surprising that we never hit anything or looked like it. And we got it corrected. And we didn't have a very effective gunnery officer. He was an Australian, nice enough chap. Wasn't red hot professionally in terms of his gunnery. And so on and so forth. And in due course, when we got inspected by our Captain D, we shot the sleeve down. So that was a turner. But we were halfway through the commission then. And that didn't speak well for other authorities. Then the flag officer destroyers, Desmond Dreyer, at the end of a NATO exercise, which was a not infrequent occurrence out there, he threw a lunch party to which all the CAs were invited. And I found myself sitting between the chief of the Allied staff, who was a delightful Italian full admiral, who I happen to know was madly in love with my admiral's wife, on one side, and then came the admiral's wife. The admiral himself sat opposite, and on my other hand was a frightfully senior Turkish captain, and I was only a fairly young commander. And then there was somebody else, and then at the end of the table was a very nice chap whose name I can't recall, was the flag lieutenant. And I started off talking to the Italian admiral, but I knew I wasn't going to get very far with him, because he would spend the entire period of lunch chatting up the admiral's wife. And so I turned to the Turkish captain. And I addressed him in English, and he growled something. He was a very dour man, very dour. And I thought, oh God, you know, I've got a problem here. And I tried him with more English, and he sort of shook his head and grunted. And then I tried him in my worst schoolboy French. And he managed to get out something that approximated to a comprend pas, but that was about the end of his vocabulary. And so forth. And so I thought, what the hell do I do now? And I turned to the flag lieutenant and spoke across the Turkish captain. I knew the flag lieutenant passing well, and he was a nice lad. And I said, Flags, the Turkish captain sitting beside me here is most interested in your range of duties, so keep him entertained. But he was no fool, and he'd heard a bit of what was going on. And he willfully disobeyed my order, turned to whoever was sitting on his left and got deeply engaged in conversation. So I'd headed. And I thought that it was probably better for the sake of others who might listen in or catch the odd word, if I was going to have to talk at this chap. And I thought it might seem better if I talked at him in my ghastly schoolboy French than if I did so in fluent English, which I proceeded to do. And I said things like, is it not remarkable, drawing on my strictly limited vocabulary, is it not remarkable how at times the sea is pink and the sky is green, and the sun is not shining at all. But there again, of course, the sea can be white, and the sun can be blue, and the sky is pink. Is that not so? You have experienced this. And so on. And I rabbited on. And after a bit, between mouthfuls, I found that I'd really worked up quite a head of steam. And all this unfortunate man, who fortunately didn't understand a word of what I was saying, and he kept on. Occasionally, he'd sort of given up doing other than grunt, because comprend pas, he'd run out of comprend pas, and so forth. And I worked up such a head of steam that I hadn't finished my main course, and everybody else had. And there was I, in full flight, saying, yet again, is it not remarkable, especially to someone as distinguished as you, sir, to observe that the sea is a sickly green, while the sun is pink, and the sky is white as a sheet. And I suddenly looked up, and there was my admiral, fixing me with a withering glance and stopping just short of tapping his forehead. He took a lot of explaining away afterwards. At one stage, we went, a single ship visit, we went to Heraklion in Crete. And we arrived there at 7 o'clock in the morning, lovely day, brilliant sunshine, absolutely flat calm, and we ran straight in, through the entrance, straight in, alongside the Moe. And I spent most of the morning going the usual rather tedious round of calling on the mayor and the chief of police and the archbishop and all that lot. And our embassy in Athens had sent down I think it was a first secretary, whose name I can't recall, but I'm still in touch with him, actually. Very nice man. And he came round with me. And it was a long morning, and everywhere you went, you got an enormously tall glass of frightfully fizzy, extremely cold lemonade. So the latter half of the morning, you were bursting for a pee, not the slightest opportunity of getting one, but faced with another tall, fizzy lemonade, and so on. Meantime, we were squaring the ship off and rigging the awnings and putting up bunting and so forth, because that night we were going to hold an official cocktail party for all and sundry. And at about, well, sometime in the early afternoon, the wind freshened, and it went on freshening. And by 4 o'clock, when virtually all the preparations had been made, it was blowing half a gale. And left with the prospect of not wishing to turn out other than the duty part of the watch, I took a decision that, as the weather seemed to be going on deteriorating, that having just got all the stuff up, we'd have to take it all down again and do it below decks, in my cabin and the wardroom and the passage between and that sort of thing. And so the poor sailors had to take it all down again, which they did, including the awning and so forth. And by 6 o'clock, when the party was due to start, it was blowing a full gale. And meantime, we'd put out every wire we had, including hurricane hawsers and that sort of thing. And fortunately, the wind was blowing straight across the jetty to which we were secured, and blowing us off the inner side of the jetty. And already the harbour was cluttered with fishing smacks and local craft and so forth. Well, the cocktail party started, and it was remarkable, and I shall never forget it, that there were very few local dignitaries, other than the ones I've mentioned that I'd already called on, and they all came. And so, to fill up the numbers and so forth, local, very ordinary farmers were brought in. And they were absolute salt-of-the-earth stuff, and they came in with collarless shirts but a single stud in front, and that sort of thing. Couldn't speak a word of English, or I of Greek, come to that, or any of my officers, except for this first secretary, who spoke fluently. And they went for him as if he was God, because he had apparently been there helping with the resistance during the final year of the war. And they thought he was, they virtually worshipped him. And so forth. As far as I was concerned, and my unfortunate officers, we just did a dumb Crambo show, and we said, score, or whatever you do in Anglo-Greek, and so forth. And that was it. In the course of the 2 hours or so of the party, we came from 4 hours' notice for steam to 10 minutes' notice for steam. And the ship wasn't bumping, but it was blowing very unpleasantly indeed. Well, then the party broke up, and they all disappeared ashore. And the first secretary was all set to take me and others ashore to some bar or restaurant that he knew for supper and a bit of a night out. And I decided that I'd send my first lieutenant, but I was going to stay put. I didn't like the look of things much. And there was nothing else we could put out. And anyway, we were at 10 minutes' notice for steam, and I reckon it was my job to stay put, which I did. And about 9 o'clock or so, I went up to my open bridge to sniff the air and see what it was like. And while I was standing there, quietly minding my own business, I got absolutely soaked to the skin with a green wave that came over the jetty and came over my open bridge. So I thought, right. First thing I did was to lower a boat and send it up to the root of the jetty to stop any liberty man coming back along the jetty, otherwise they might well have been washed over and drowned. And I put on my seagoing things, which were waterproof, and returned to the bridge. By midnight, when leave expired, we had practically everybody back on board, certainly all the officers. And the weather was showing no sign of letting up. During the course of the party earlier, I had, through this first secretary who spoke the lingo, I tackled the harbour master and asked what was the prospect of getting out under these weather conditions. And he said, zero. And that was that. By 2 o'clock in the morning, we had parted everything except for one hurricane hawser forward and one hurricane hawser aft. And I forget which way around it was, but one of those was fraying. And we'd nothing else to put out. They'd all gone. And so I decided that we had no option. We had to make a boat for it. And I was fairly far from sanguine that we could get out, because harbour was absolutely cluttered with shipping by this time. And so all the usual preps had to be waived, and I didn't prepare an anchor ready for letting go or put a cable party on the forecastle. Indeed, I cleared the forecastle so that there was nobody there. And I let go of the stern rope, and the ship swung round until she was pointing bows more or less towards the jetty, which was the direction from which the wind was coming. And this meant I had at least a right angle turn and not very much room in which to complete it before getting through the hole, when I had to make a further right angle turn in the opposite direction, and that would take me out into the open sea. And I wasn't at all sure that this was going to be possible. And I visualized ending up amongst the fishing boats, and it would all be a pretty messy business. Well, I let go the stern rope, and I rang on high revolutions, and I screwed the engines to give the corkscrew effect, knowing that I would part the forward hurricane hawser. But that didn't matter because I wasn't terribly happy about standing on an open bridge when it parted. But so, there it was. And every degree that one gained counted. And we screwed a few degrees, but not very many, before it parted. And I rang on 26 knots and made a boat for it. And we got through. I'm still not quite sure how or why, but we did. And that was that. And I was so relieved when we eventually got out into the open sea. And then I received a signal from my admiral saying, join him in whatever the other big port was, where himself and one or two other ships and the rest of the squadron were, and so on. So that was that, and it was... that really was close to being another life, but I haven't marked it as such. Well, various other things went on.
Can I just ask, did you feel... I know that when you took over the ship that you had your eye problem, your eyesight problem, but did you feel daunted in taking over this new ship? Were you... not so much apprehensive, but almost overwhelmed by it, or was it just another aspect of your career which you couldn't wait to get going on?
I think it's true to say, and you're dishonest if you pretend otherwise, that delighted though you are at it, at the prospect, your first command is to a considerable extent daunting anyway, regardless of what size it may be. Oh. And this is inevitable, I think. And you're dishonest if you pretend otherwise. Once you've done it, then you've got an enormously increased measure of self-confidence, and you can weather it. And the fact that you go to something bigger then is of far less relevance, consequence.
And of course you inherit the officers and men you're given, with the exception of your dipso boatswain's mate. Who eventually you dealt with in the way that you've described, but you said that some of your officers were mediocre. You just have to work around that, do you?
Yes, that's it. I mean, you have some outstandingly good officers, and some. Hopefully, if they're outstandingly bad, you can get rid of them. But it takes time, and you have to go through a lot of things. But you see, we all joined as an entirely new team when we. Recommissioned and so forth.
Yeah.
And they were, they all buckled down.
Just but, as a final question then on this before we move on, when you took over the ship, you said it was in fairly poor order. Mm. How did it get into that state? It wouldn't have been left that like that by the previous captain, would it?
Yes.
It was.
It was. The previous captain was a very nice man. I'm friends with him still. He didn't go any further. He was a submariner, I think. He just didn't bother. Simply didn't bother. Didn't think it mattered. Took it as a matter of course. And the ship was sloppy. It was as simple as that. But when, although we got things to a barely acceptable standard in the 3 weeks we had in. We had to adjust in terms of sheer hygiene below decks. But it wasn't until we punched a hole in our side in Gibraltar and went in for a 2.5 month refit, by the end of which we had the ship properly up. And that was recognized by Desmond Dreyer, who threw a cocktail party on board us, and we flew his flag going somewhere, and so on and so forth. And she was smart then.
Right.
But it took time, of course. And we couldn't have done that overnight. We couldn't have done that, really, much short of something like a refit, which he should never have been let go to that extent.
And you and the First Lieutenant are responsible really for bringing the ship up to standard between
yes.
the two of you.
Yeah. And the navigating officer's good. He retired eventually as a full admiral. And we had brilliant's the wrong word, a terribly nice and a very sound and a remarkable character, Gunner Tears. He was a lieutenant, I think, maybe a sub-lieutenant. Great character. And the rest were perfectly nice, but not a great deal there. And the next one down from the first lieutenant, the number two, was really nearly a disaster. But he never did anything so bad or so wrong or failed to do it sufficiently right that you really felt justified in sacking him.
Yes.
And I remember while we were talking about him, and I'm not going to mention his name, the time came for me to write his confidential report. And this is a list of attributes which cover virtually everything, you know, power of command, this, that, other than which, and so on. And the highest mark you can give is 9. I suppose the lowest mark is 0, but practically nobody can have 0 because there must be something there, and so on. And this chap was absolutely useless, but he was a middle seniority lieutenant. Not a very nice chap either, but that's another matter. And I wrote his report, and I didn't try any funny business in terms of the verbiage, but in terms of the marking, I gave him more or less a full house of 2s, which is about the lowest I've ever given anybody. And at that point, I sent for him. Now, normally when you write in the Navy, it's different in the Army, where you actually sign your report as having read it. But in the Navy, the commanding officer is supposed to tell each individual officer the sense of the report he's written and get it reasonably accurate, but he needn't quote the number of marks he's awarded for this or that, or even specifically using identically the same language, the remarks he's made in the verbiage part. And I sent for this chap and said, I just written your confidential report. And I have to tell you, I think it's probably the worst I've ever written. So I'd like you to read it for yourself. And I sat him down in an armchair behind me, and I turned back to my desk and pretended to work. I wasn't actually getting any work done. And I wondered, quite acutely, what it would feel like when the knife was actually slipped between your ribs from behind. And the next thing I knew, without having heard him get up from the armchair, and he was standing at my elbow and handed me the report, and I looked up, wondering what would come. He said, "I think that's a very fair report, sir." And I thought I ought to up it by +2 there and then on the spot, but I'm about to say I didn't. And so on. But now, have I answered your question?
You have, yes, thank you, yes.
Well, the time came when we were going to leave the Med and go back home. And it's of interest that a week before we were due to sail, I got on to the flag lieutenant, the commander-in-chief, and said that I didn't know whether the commander-in-chief was in the habit of returning the calls of commanders in command, or whether he pitched the level a bit higher. But I'd now been on the station for 11 and a half months, and I was sailing in 1 week's time, and the commander-in-chief had not returned my call. This is Baron Bingley.
Yes.
And so forth. Whereupon he came, of course, and made a very unimpressive little statement to the ship's company, but there it was. And we all went off to Barcelona for, we were going to go to 2 places, ostensibly for a bit of bright lights before we finally cleared the Mediterranean and returned to the UK. And Barcelona was the first. And this was an unexceptional visit, perfectly ordinary operational one. And we had the usual sort of entertainment, you know, there was a dinner party with the Lord Mayor or whoever, and so forth, on the Saturday night, I suppose. And on the Sunday, various of us, certainly most of the CAs, got asked out to by locals. There was quite a British community there. And the ships were going to be open to visitors. And overnight, on the Saturday night, the local reservoir burst its banks and flooded the main, two of the main approach roads, and there were rocks and hedges and bits of stuff strewn everywhere. And at dinner that Saturday night, I had eaten an oyster or two, no more, cooked, thought they were safe, and they turned around and bit me. And by the middle of the night, I was in dead trouble, and I couldn't go to church in the morning. And I'd accepted an invitation to go to some charming people called Coates of Cotton fame, who lived in a